Welcome into the Podium Game Podcast, brought to you by the HP Basketball Network. I'm Brian Gibberman, here with one of the guys who runs Hardwood Paroxysm, Jared Dubin. Jared, how you doing this morning?
I'm doing good, man. How about you?
I'm doing well. I'm fired up because football's basically here, and I could stop pretending like I really like baseball. And once football starts, it means basketball's almost here.
Yes, I get depressed when football starts coming around because, especially this season, the Cowboys have already killed my hope.
Well, at least Dez is, like, beating up cornerbacks in practice.
Oh, Dez is the best. I could just listen to things about Dez Bryant all day.
And it sounds like your owner's son's doing a good job schmoozing up the right people. I mean, it seems like things are going in the right direction there.
Yeah, and, you know, Jerry himself is hanging out with some lovely ladies. So
I had to cut up audio about that at my job that I actually get paid for. That happened like 5 years ago.
Yeah.
Oh boy.
But the picture is just surfaced now, which makes it funny right now.
Okay, so we should probably, since we're doing a podcast about basketball, we should probably stop talking about the Cowboys. I could sit here and talk about football for hours right now. I'm so pumped for it, though. But we're going to basically, as the website, as you all know, if you're clicking on this, is just starting up. We want to do an off-season review of what's happened in the NBA. And we're going to get into all 30 teams at some point during this podcast. But right now, we're going to concentrate on the two restricted free agents that are still out there that could kind of maybe shift the landscape if they landed in the right spot. Let's start with the Pistons, Greg Monroe. What do you think's going on right there that it's taken so long with him and he hasn't really found any suitors?
I think that, you know, surprise, surprise, Zach Lowe captured it pretty perfectly in a column he wrote, I think it was last week, or I guess by the time we're recording this, it's 2 weeks ago. He is a big man who's not necessarily a transformative offensive player, but is still a very good offensive player. But he doesn't shoot well from outside, and he doesn't protect the rim. And those kind of players just aren't valued as highly as they used to be. And when you couple that with the fact that he's a restricted free agent, you see why he's not getting necessarily any offers in restricted free agency. And, yeah, I think that that's pretty much what it comes down to. It's a difficult situation, but his type of player just isn't valued as highly anymore as it would have been maybe 5 or 10 years ago.
Complicating matters for him is that the team who has his rights basically also invested tons of money in Josh Smith.
Right. And, you know, they love, obviously, Andre Drummond. And Josh Smith should be playing the four. I think we saw that last year. When they tried to pair him with Monroe and Drummond, that pairing or that trio did not work out well in any way whatsoever. The three of them playing together just is not a good idea.
Who could have ever guessed that three big guys who can't shoot playing basketball together in the year 2014 would be a terrible idea? I mean,
I think the Raptors made the triple big lineup work last year, but that was because one of those bigs was Patrick Patterson, who shoots well from three. And when they played him with Amir Johnson and Jonas, they always had one guy on the court who could shoot and two guys who could play pick and roll, and then one guy who could capably guard bigger wings in either Patterson or Amir. So it was a three-big lineup that wasn't necessarily the greatest thing in the world, but made some sort of sense. The Josh, Monroe, and Drummond trio, there's no shooting there. There's only one really good pick-and-roll dive guy. And, you know, Monroe sort of needs the ball in the post to be able to do his damage. But when you do that, it clogs the lane because Josh and Drummond can't shoot. So it's a very difficult situation to make work.
Is there a team that you think Monroe is a good fit on?
Off the top of my head, you need a team that needs like a big who can function in the post and also work as a passer. You know, Chicago pre-Cal would have made some sense next to Noah, I think. As an alternative to Taj Gibson, Brooklyn would have made sense because, you know, KG never stays healthy and you could have used him next to Brook Lopez. I'm trying to think.
Memphis if they didn't have Zach Randolph. Gasol's the kind of center he could have played with.
Right, that too. I mean, Boston just needs big guys in general. Their big guys are more, you know, of the backup variety. It's hard to shoehorn him onto a good team because good teams generally have good bigs already.
Yeah, it's a weird situation. All right, Eric Bledsoe, I think's a little more interesting. I see both sides in this. The Suns' four-year, $48 million offer is probably right about what his value is. That's what Kyle Lowry got. But he's sitting there, and he's looking, and he's seeing free agents like Chandler Parsons and Gordon Hayward get these max offers, and he's better than those players. And yet, no one's going after him and overpaying for him. So I understand him wanting more, and I also understand the Suns' perspective that they think they're doing right by him.
Yeah, I'm with you on both counts. I think that what's not necessarily considered in the Hayward and Parsons calculus there is that wing is somewhat shallow, especially at the two-guard spot. So you pay a little bit of a premium to get those guys, especially when they're restricted. Where the point guard is probably the deepest position in the league, and paying a premium for talent at the deepest position in the league doesn't make much sense. I've written previously this summer that if Bledsoe got a max offer sheet, that Phoenix should just back it. I think that he has a rare skill set in terms of two-way play and versatility, and he can defend both backcourt positions and play both backcourt positions on offense, which is a rare thing for someone that young. But I also understand where Phoenix is coming from.
What I like about what you just said, and I think it's very important to point this out, I don't like how some people are pigeonholing Bledsoe as just a point guard because, as you talked about, he can play both guard positions. So the idea he's just a player. I don't like the position thing with him, which is why, say, and this can transition us into the Atlanta Hawks offseason, a team like Atlanta, who's having all this trouble getting a star player in there, why wouldn't they, instead of giving Thabo $4 million, kept open their what would have been, if it wasn't enough for Max, really, really close, when I'm pretty sure it would have been enough for Max, and throw an offer out that like him, see if the Suns were bluffing, and then have Horford, Millsap, Teague, and Korver as your starting five? And, I mean, is that the best team in the East if they get Bledsoe? There's an argument there. It's close.
I think that teams like that aren't really in the mix for true superstar types, Bledsoe is the kind of guy they should go after. I definitely agree with that. Whether or not he would have taken that money is up for debate. You know, you see all these different guys that supposedly turned down the Hawks' money, so maybe they try to get him, but Bledsoe just said no. You know, wouldn't necessarily know about that, I think. But yeah, that team would have been excellent. I'm with you on that.
All right, so what the Hawks did do, they added Thabo, Kent Bazemore, re-signed Shelvin Mack, lost Cartier-Martin. They're kind of a weird team. I don't really know what their long-term direction is. They have Millsaps up after this year. He's on an amazing contract, but he's gone. He's not necessarily gone, but he either needs to be re-signed or he's going to move on. And Horford's up after next year. So they have a nice team in place, but it's not necessarily set up to be there long term.
Yeah, I think basically what it comes down to for them is they just want shooting all over the court, and they'll take it however they can get it, which is an interesting strategy when you think about how important spacing is these days. You know, long term, I think that they have their, although, even that, I guess I can't really say, because Sacks' contract is after the 15-16 season. I was going to say, I think they have one of the long-term pillars, and I'm sure they can keep Millsap, but, you know, you never know what's going to happen. I don't know how they're set up long-term. I do kind of like what they wound up doing this summer after they did get the top guys. I think that Tabo was a good signing for them. The Bazemore and Mack signings, I think, are a little bit less important. But I also like when they did the draft. You got Adrian Payne, another forward who can shoot. Go with Millsap, Horford, and Antich, which is not, and Mike Scott. So I think that they did pretty well, all things considered.
Yeah, Atlanta, they were a good team last year when they were fully healthy. So can Horford not have one of his pecs break this year and see what happens? They're an interesting team to watch. Boston.
I'm actually writing about them for a different site for tomorrow. So
okay.
How I think that they're, you know, not necessarily Atlanta or Chicago level Eastern contender, but in the next row.
Yeah, I agree with that. I don't know if there's no real lock playoff team after the first two. I think there's like a really big group in the East that anyone could really kind of make it. But they're definitely in that mix, and I would say they're more towards the top of that next level group than in the middle of it. One team that's not in that group, Boston. They had a quiet summer. Re-signed Avery Bradley, added Evan Turner, lost Chris Humphreys and Jared Bayless. And they're basically just in wait-and-see mode and trying to move their picks for something. There's nothing. It's just they're waiting.
Yeah, they sort of struck out trying to move those picks for something this summer. We've heard all the rumors about trying to get it on the Kevin Books, which obviously that didn't wind up happening for them. But they're still set up well. Like, they're set up much better for the future than you'd think based on their roster, because they have about, I think, 9 draft picks and 4 drafts from, you know, various trades that they made. The KG and Pierce trade, and then the selling Doc Rivers, basically, to the Clippers. So they have a lot of picks in the next few drafts, and every time you have that many picks, you can package them with some assets to get something better.
They also had one of my favorite drafts, Marcus Smart and James Young. I thought it was really good. I thought they added 2 nice pieces there.
I love James Young.
Yeah, and what it does is it sets up the point where it doesn't really look like Rajon Rondo's. His contract's up after this year. He doesn't really make sense to play with Marcus Smart. So after Love, with Love now dealt, he kind of becomes the next obvious candidate to be moved, whether it be before the season or at the trade deadline.
Yeah, I agree. I think that will happen. You know, I heard during the season that they were trying to move him this summer. Obviously, that hasn't happened yet, but that doesn't mean it won't. There's still a lot of offseason left. So, I mean, we'll see what happens there, but I think that you're right in that no longer fits their timeline, unless they wind up packaging some of those picks to get someone else, you know, before Rondo leaves.
The Brooklyn Nets had a very weird offseason from the Jason Kidd debacle. They hired Lionel Hollins. I thought that was a pretty good rebound for them with how that situation played out. The only free agency move they made was they brought back Allen Anderson. They did lose Sean Livingston and Paul Pierce. So they kind of lost the identity that they built and ended up having success with last year.
Somewhat, but I think it came out in the whole kid thing. I think that Lionel is clearly a better coach, both, you know, in a vacuum and for that team. And I think that, especially with Brooke Lopez back, he makes more sense for them. If that makes sense.
Yeah, no, absolutely. What I was actually talking about with the identity was more how what Livingston and Pierce were kind of 2 of the really important pieces in how they got to playing small ball and were playing well under Kidd last year, more than the coaching change. Because I agree with you. I think the Hollins is an upgrade to Kidd, even though I like Kidd as a coach.
Yeah, so that definitely makes sense. But with Brooke back, I think they were going to move away from small ball anyway. So I think that, you know, either way, still wound up coming ahead.
Pierce didn't get a ton of money. I was kind of surprised they didn't bring him back.
Yeah, so was I. But then you heard the thing about Collins sort of wanting to cut costs a little bit, which given how much money he spent the last few years to have a team that's, I mean, first and second round outs, makes somewhat sense. But, you know, his whole draw was that he was never going to cut costs. So I guess we'll see what happens. But, I mean, if they wanted to stay in sort of the rut that they were in the Eastern Conference contending, then I think that, you know, they should have brought him back. But I also think that at some point you just have to move on and try to start the next era. And I guess that means, you know, sort of building around Brook now.
Yeah, which it's so hard for them to move on to that next era, as you talked about the team before. That's where their draft picks are all going pretty much every other year for the next 15 years.
Right.
The Hornets, did they take a jump? Did they make that next step? Or did they stay stagnant, Tio?
I think that other than... Okay, so Dallas outside of the fact that they got... in a trade, had my favorite offseason of 2018. And I think Charlotte was next. I think they got Lance on a steal of a contract, and I think that he helps move them up into the upper echelon of Eastern Conference teams. You know, two-way players that age, that good, just don't hit unrestricted free agency all that often. And I think that to get him at a below market deal, just because he's a little bit crazy, was a great move. There's not much more to say about that being a good move, other than that it was a really good move. And I think that that'll help push them into the top of the, not necessarily the top where, you know, Cleveland is going to be, but I think below Cleveland and Chicago, I think that Charlotte is right there, Atlanta and Washington and Toronto, in terms of being, you know, the next best teams in the East.
Thought Lance was the best. I thought that was the best signing of the offseason.
Yeah, in terms of dollar for dollar value, it goes Dirk and then Lance.
Yeah. The one question they have, they lost McRoberts and Tolliver. McRoberts generated a lot of ball movement from them, which is important with some of the players they have. When you have like Al Jefferson as your center, to have a guy next to him that can be a good ball mover, I do think is important. And then Tolliver generated a lot of spacing for them with his shooting. He shot over 40% from three. They did sign Marvin Williams. It'll be interesting to see what kind of percentages he shoots with that team, because Tolliver, that was basically a career year for him. So I'll see if they can kind of replicate what they're able to do for Tolliver with Marvin Williams.
Yeah, I think that Marvin gets too much hate. I know he got drafted before Chris Paul and Darren Williams and didn't turn out to be nearly as good as them. But that doesn't mean that he is valueless. You know, he's a perfectly capable 3-4 combo guy. You know, he's not going to light the world on fire, but he's solid enough that he can work as either a small forward or a small ball power forward in certain lineups, and I think that he's just fine. You know, he's not going to make or break your team, but he's also not going to kill you, and I think he could provide some spacing from the 4 spot and then some defense. Not necessarily lockdown defense, but able to body up bigger wing guys at the 3. So I think that that was a pretty good signing.
All right.
Not a little bit too much money, but I think if you had told me before the summer that they would get him and Lance for $16 million combined, I would have said, okay, Lance for $11 and Morgan for $5, that makes sense. And they overpaid one by $2 million and underpaid the other by $2 million, so it's fine.
Yeah, and then Roberts is a nice backup point guard also who could provide some more shooting. All right, the next two teams, the two best team, generally considered the best two teams in the East. We'll start with the Bulls. I'm going to put the Bulls like this. I think they got better, but I also didn't like what they did. I don't get investing that much in POW when you have when he's not going to play at the end of games. It just doesn't make sense to me. I think it would have made more sense for another team that I think would have made more sense for them to go after someone like Lance. So you're also getting Rose insurance, having another creator and someone who could play at the end of games.
Yeah, I think that if you pretended that the Bulls weren't chasing Melo and just said at the start of the offseason that they're going to amnesty Boozer, they're going to get Pau Gasol, bring over Mrotić, and bring in Doug McDermott, I think you would have said, wow, that's a really good offseason. I think that it's somewhat clouded by the Melo pursuit and the fact that they, again, failed to get the big star they were chasing. But I think they did well for what they ended up doing.
I don't like Pau as... Look, he's not the same player he was, but that was like their kind of their top target after Melo. Just, I don't think, really fit.
Yeah, I think that there are other targets that might have made equal or more sense. But I also think that Pau is, a genius level offensive player and passer. And to be able to pair him on the court with Noah or Gibson, depending on different lineups, I think is going to work out really well. And, maybe he doesn't play the end of the game every game, but I think that he will play at the end of the game enough that, and even if he doesn't play at the end of the game, I think it was still worth it to bring him in.
And no, what Pau at this point in his career is clearly better at center. I actually think it's helpful for Noah that he can maybe guard some power forwards and not have to beat up his body as much banging down low. That could be something that's useful for them.
Yeah, and I think it also it helps Pau to go to a really good defensive team. He was really, really bad on defense last year. Maybe playing for Tibbs and alongside Noah and Gibson and Butler and all those guys will help sort of reinvigorate him.
Well, I'm looking forward to see if Tony Snell's summer league was just summer league or if that's something that's going to carry over to the season.
Yeah, I never put much stuff in summer league, so I can't say I'm excited to see that or not. I sort of like Snell coming out of college as long as they don't try to ask him to do too much. So I think that that's generally where I'm at with him.
The other team atop the East, the Cavaliers. I think anything besides saying they have to make some slight improvements is overreacting to anything that's going on there. I mean,
they had the best offseason of the league because they got the best player.
And then traded for
the low trade or not, they're going to be a heck of a lot better next year than they were last year. I think that that's, the most obvious call in the league. I think their one weakness is interior defense, or not necessarily one weakness, but their biggest weakness is interior defense. Varejão is really the only rim protector they have on the roster. And, it's basically a guarantee that he's going to get hurt at some point. Like, that's the most obvious thing I think anyone could predict. He always gets hurt. So, we'll see what happens there. But that's a team that's clearly going to be better next year.
Yeah, and to somehow... It's good for the Timberwolves that they're getting Andrew Wiggins. That's a better return than pretty much any team's ever gotten for a superstar to get the number one pick. Love the amount of putting LeBron with that kind of shooting. I think that defensively it doesn't fit as well together as Miami did, but I think from an offensive perspective that those Love, LeBron, and Kyrie actually should mesh easier together than the transition was in Miami.
I think it'll take some time, like everything does. None of that stuff ever works right away. You saw how long it took for the Miami guys to come together. And Spo is, one of the best coaches the league, and it still took him a while to figure it out. David Blatt's one of the best coaches in Europe, but I think it'll still take him a while to figure it out too.
We brought up, you already brought up this team, Dallas. You said they had one of your favorite off seasons. Why don't you explain why?
I thought that they got a lot better on defense, you know, in the Tyson Chandler trade. They brought back Devin Harris for very little money, which was a nice move. They got Chandler Parsons, which injects some, you know, versatility and creativity on the wing that they didn't necessarily have last year. And they also brought in Jimmy Nelson for the room section, who I think can slide in and provide, if not necessarily Calderon level production, a close facsimile of what they got out of Calderon last year. And they also got Richard Pearson for the minimum, which is crazy. Like, that is a crazy good value deal. I know that people don't really like Richard Pearson anymore because he's old and sort of slow, but he's still a very useful player. So I thought that that was a really good deal for that too.
Yeah, and the role there, to ask him, he's not going to need to be what he was for the Jazz last year. I mean, he's probably a 10 to 15 minute a guy on that team.
Right. That's definitely correct.
With them, the one thing it comes down to me is basically with Tyson, is whether last year was him mentally checking out or if he's really declined.
I think a lot of it was mentally checking out. I mean, you could see that when the Knicks were floundering. He just did not want to be there, basically.
Yeah, I would.
And he did not want to play for Mike Woodson.
No, they seem to have some issues there. The Nuggets, they didn't really do anything. That's just a weird team.
Yeah, I think they got good value on the draft day trade in terms of getting, you know, 16-19 for the number 11. I thought that that was pretty good. Most of their improvement, I think, is going to be internal this year. They're replacing, you know, the J.J. Dixon minutes with Gallo and McGee coming back, and they got Aaron Aflalo for Fournier, which I thought was a good deal.
Oh, I forgot.
Gary Harris. Yeah, the Aflalo deal was good for them. They gave up very little to get a big upgrade at a perimeter spot. And, you know, they're still very Nuggets-like in that they have a lot of guys who can play the 2, 3, and 4, and they had Ty Lawson, and they have sort of a jumbled mess at center. In Mozgov and Hickson and JaVale. I think that they could cobble together a competent center out of the three of those guys. I like Mozgov the best of the three. I think that JaVale is not good, and I think that Hickson is not good. I don't think I'm alone in those opinions, but I think that clearly the strength of their team is at the 2, 3, and 4 with Apollo, Gallo, Chandler, Fareed, Gary Harris, Quincy Miller even. They have a lot of guys for not very many to those spots.
A lot of their improvement outside of the guys returning from injuries could be lineup-based. I mean, Shaw played Hickson and Fareed way too much together last year.
Yeah, you would hope that they never played together.
It was really weird. All right, another kind of weird team that I'm not really sure where they're going, the Pistons. Did you like or dislike the Jody Meeks deal? A lot of people thought that was one of the big overpays of the summer.
Well, I think that they gave him too much money, but I also think that he doesn't necessarily cure their biggest fault from last year, but he addresses it. You know, they were one of the two or three worst outside shooting teams in the league, and you know, Meeks, in theory, is a good shooter, and he's been a good shooter. I think he's over 37 or 38% from three in his career. He's not necessarily going to be playing in the D'Antoni, you know, shoot to your heart's content offense like he was last year. But he, I think, immediately is either the second or third best shooter on that roster.
And the rest of what they did, nothing. Augustine at $3 million for 2 years is fine. Crom Butler got a 2-year deal. The second year is not guaranteed. I know that was kind of, Butler was kind of criticized. I actually don't mind having his veteran presence around Andre Drummond. I think that's something that could be good for that team, having a guy like that. He taken on kind of a mentor role for a bunch of the young guys on the team, and it doesn't hurt them long term. So I don't really they didn't do anything that kills themselves in the future, and they got to get some development from within, whether it be Drummond, Kentavious Caldwell-Pope. I mean, those guys are going to have to get better for this team to make a jump.
So, I mean, you know how I feel about the veteran leadership thing. If that's the only reason you're signing a guy, that probably means he's not good and he shouldn't play. I think Caron is a little bit better than that. He can provide, you know, like Meeks, he can provide a little bit of shooting and he can play a little bit of defense, much more than Meeks can. But I think if you're counting on Caron Butler as your guy to take you to another level, that's a problem. The biggest upgrade they made was Stan. Stan is a genius level coach, and he'll be able to get things out of the team that, you know, Mo Cheeks could never dream of, because Mo Cheeks is the least imaginative coach in the last 10 years or so.
It's funny that, yeah, there's no question that Stan Van Gundy was the best addition that team made, at least from a coaching perspective. The general manager part, we're still going to have to wait and see. It's funny how these teams in alphabetical order got grouped together. Cleveland and Chicago right next to each other. Now these next two teams, both in the West, I think probably would be considered the two most controversial off-seasons out of anyone. The Warriors. Where do you stand on them not taking advantage of the opportunity when it was there to trade Clay for Kevin Love?
I've said this on Twitter a couple times. We're going to look back in 4 or 5 years like we looked back on the Baby Bulls not trading some of those guys for Kevin Garnett. I mean, I think that this is one of the worst non-moves in a while. There's nothing more really to say about it. Klay Thompson's a nice player, and because the two-guard position is so shallow, he's by default one of the better two guards in the league. But, I mean, they're going to have to pay him $15, $16 million a year starting next year. And, I mean, he's just not good enough to be making that much money. Like, he can do, he's a terrific shooter, one of the best in the league. And he certainly helps Curry with his ability to bend point guards. But this is just not a guy that's a transformative player. And he's going to wind up getting a max contract next year. And that's just, I mean, they could have Kevin Love for him and ditch David Lee's contract in the process. Kevin Love is a shooter that warps the defense just by stepping on the floor. Klay Thompson, as good of a shooter as he is, doesn't do that. And I don't think the fact that he can defend point guards better than Curry can is worth not giving him up for Kevin Love. I think it's insane.
It really was amazing. And it's not like it was a short-term solution. I mean, Curry and Love are your two building blocks, maybe for the next 8 to 9 years.
Right. You know, Love is already a top, 5 to 10 player in the league. If you put his shooting and Curry's shooting on the court at the same time, I mean, it's just dead defenses. You can cobble together a defense around those guys, People try to paint Love as if he's like the worst defender in the league, and if you have him on the floor, your defense is just atrocious. That just has not been true when he's been in Minnesota with very few other, good defensive players on the team. And if you have Bogut and Iguodala surrounding him, I mean, those two guys have basically been a recipe for a top 10 defense on their own over the course of their careers. And, obviously Bogut gets hurt a bunch. And it's, Iguodala is getting older. But, I mean, if you compare the two of them with Curry and Love, that's a recipe for one of the five best teams in the league, I think. And they just didn't do it because Steve Kerr wants to coach Klay Thompson or something like that? I don't know.
It's ironic.
Yeah, I think it's crazy.
I like that you brought up the defense point. I don't know what it was. For one of the Suns games, when they played them, I picked it out and I did nothing but watch Kevin Love on defense. And look, he wasn't the best, and this is only one game, and it's not fair to judge someone off of one game, but I was kind of surprised at how he wasn't nearly as awful as the reputation made him out to be. When you sat there...
He's not a good defender. Like, on the court, he's a negative on defense. Like, I think that that's clear. But he's not a guy where you put him on the court, your defense is done. Like, that's just not true. Listen, anytime you have a superstar with some trade discussions, he's going to get picked apart. It happened with Melo, it happened with Dwight, and it's happening with Love. I think his bad defense is a bit oversold, and his transformative qualities on offense are being a little bit undersold, which is crazy to me.
And they added someone in Sean Livingston, who he doesn't have the shooting that Clay does, but playing next to Curry could have done some of those things that he, or could do all those things that Clay does on defense.
Yeah, he could have done some of those things on defense. And then you combine him with the replacement shooting and Love, I think it would have been, a good trade-off there.
And when they originally signed Livingston, that's exactly what I thought they were doing.
Right, and that would have made sense, but obviously they didn't see it that way. They had that opportunity pre-draft. Them and the Bulls both could have presented better offers before the draft. And then, we never know if LeBron was planning on going to Cleveland the whole time. But I think it's clear from his letter and the way Cleveland is acting now that, this Love thing was preordained by the time he got there. Maybe if that one of those teams had traded for Love, maybe LeBron doesn't even leave, I think that may be going a little too far, but we can't know for sure.
Houston, another controversial offseason. I feel like, and I wrote about this recently, a lot of people don't really like what they did, and I think it's part of that concept of what you talked about earlier. When you miss on the big fish, everyone kind of, there's a reaction to that. And the Parsons thing, I'm working under the assumption that, and Zach Lowe brought this up in an article, that they had to let him go as part of, in conjunction with signing Dwight. I think that's a logical assumption to make. I think they ended up making, I think they're better than they were last year. They got Ariza to replace Parsons. They're bringing back Troy Daniels, who is showed some ability to shoot. And then Joey Dorsey and Jeff Adrian could end up being two signings by Morey that are kind of overlooked, but he gets production out of players on low-level contracts like he's done in the past.
I don't know if I'd go so far as to say they're better than last year. They lost a lot of valuable depth. They don't have Oshik anymore. They don't have Parsons anymore. Those were three of their top six guys. It's not just easily replaceable. Most people are talking about the offseason in terms of, they let Parsons walk and they missed on Bosch and whoever else they were chasing in free agency. But I think that losing their depth is a big part of why the offseason didn't go so well for them too.
Oshik only played in 48 games last year. They actually
because he was pouting.
Yeah, they had a better record when he didn't play than when he played, percentage-wise. Lynn, here's the thing with Lynn. He wasn't really a good fit with Harden, so you were only getting the best out of him for about 10 minutes a night. So you're just looking to replace...
But I think that's still better than not having him at all.
I think you can generate, with their roster, they will find ways to generate they just need to generate some sort of offensive creation to make sure the team doesn't die when Harden goes off the court.
I really like Isaiah Cannon.
Yeah.
He's really strong, and he can shoot the hell out of the ball. He's another guy who looked really good in summer league. He was sort of the focal point of Houston's offense out there. And he was incredible when he went down to the D League last year.
And Nick Johnson, who, again, what they do is they've set themselves up that they just need one of these guys to hit and be good and be able to take on that role. I think the starting lineup's better because is Parsons a better overall player than Ariza? Yes. But I think Ariza also fits better to help cover up Harden's flaws.
If you get the Ariza that is contract year Ariza, that's true. If you get the Ariza that has been non-contract year Ariza in his career, then that may not be true. You know, I think that he'll be able to shoot well playing off of Dwight and Harden. Most guys are able to do that. I don't necessarily get the bruise he got last year, though.
That's fair. One of the teams who I think had far and away one of the worst off seasons, even before Paul George went down. I just don't get what Indiana was doing. Why wouldn't you? Their path to getting above what they've been was basically Paul George and Lance Stephenson hitting their peak development. And who knows what happens with George now. I mean, that's terrible what happened to him, and you don't wish that upon anyone. And then they just decided that they didn't want to keep Lance Stephenson for whatever reason, which I still don't grasp.
Yeah, I didn't get them making any of those lower-level signings before they figured out how much room they had under the tax after re-signing Lance. I thought that should have been move number one, not move number four or five. Didn't make much sense to me. Again, I agree with you that their path to improvement was through Lance and Paul George and Roy Hibbert. Like, they need to get more of Hibbert. They did out of him last year down the stretch of the playoffs, but what? Now, you know, their team this year at least is going to have to be run West. In theory, I like the DJ Miles signing as sort of a back 2-3 to Lance and George. Now he's going to have to stretch his role. We'll see if he can. I thought that he was a nice sort of bench shooter signing. If he has to be more than that, I think it's asking too much.
Yeah, I like CJ Miles, but that was playing off of George and Stephenson. I don't like him as playing off Rodney Stuckey and George Hill.
Oh boy, do I not like Stuckey. Oh man. One of my least favorite guys in the league just to watch. He's going to have to be a foundational player for them on offense too. Him and George Hill are going to have to stretch their abilities to the fullest.
I understood why they signed Stuckey once they lost Stephenson. They needed to try and recreate some of that shot creation to take some pressure off George. So it made sense from a fit standpoint, but he's just not as good of a player. But the Clippers addressed one of their biggest weaknesses from last year. They got a third big in Spencer Hawes that's actually a functioning NBA player. They also upgraded the backup point guard spot, going from Darren Collison to Jordan Farmer, and they brought back Glenn Davis. Did they do enough to get themselves past the Spurs, Thunder, or maybe put themselves closer with those teams?
Somewhat. The Hawes move was pretty good. Like you said, he's a person who can walk and shoot guard at the same time at the third big, which is better than what they had last year. I thought that they needed to go for a defensive big more than a shooting big, but you take what you can get. I think people don't like Hawes, so they think that that's a bad signing. But I mean, he got the same amount as Chris Kanan, and he's a far better player.
I like Hawes as a player. I just think he has some flaws.
Well, I think that people don't like Hawes as a person.
Oh, because all the... Yeah, okay.
Yeah.
Good point. That's valid.
Well, you know, the majority of the NBA fan base is very liberal, and Hawes is very not. And I think that turns people against... And he's very vocally not as well. So I think that turns people against him somewhat. But he's a good shooter. And anytime you can get shooting from a big, it's good. So, I mean, I question whether he can play next to DeAndre Jordan, really. just because neither one of them can really, you know, guard power forwards, I think. It'll be difficult to see how they match that up. But, you know, in terms of providing spacing around Blake Griffin pick and rolls in the middle of the court, I think that's going to work out well.
The other team in Los Angeles, I don't even know. They just kind of, once they missed on their guys that they wanted, they gave the Nick Young contract's the only one I don't really understand.
Well, I think the Jordan Hill contract makes less sense than the Nick Young contract, because especially after they drafted Drangle and then, you know, won the Carlos Boozer auction.
But,
well, I guess the Boozer auction was after the Jordan Hill signing. I thought that they did well to rent their cap space for a first-round pick with the Jeremy Lin trade. Say whatever you want about Lin. When he's an offensive focal point, he's shown that he can handle a very large offensive load. And, you know, if Steve Nash is hurt, they're going to need somebody other than Kobe Bryant to do some creating there. And I thought that the Randall pick was good. I think he's going to be one of the better players in the draft. And, again, they got value in terms of the Lin deal, too, because they picked up an extra first-round pick when they're going to be losing theirs for probably going to be losing theirs if he doesn't land in the top five in the Nash trade that they made a couple years ago. But the Jordan Hill contract and the Nick Young contract, and I mean, I just don't know what they were doing in terms of free agency moves outside of, you know, the draft and picking up the pick in the Lin trade.
Well, the Hill I can live with because, well, it was an overpay, yes, but it's a one-year deal with the team option, so it's not doing anything long-term. As you talked about, they're parking their cap space and they're trying to free up. So why are you signing Nick Young through 2017-2018? And it's a player option for that year. That's what doesn't make sense to me.
Yeah, I mean, I like Nick Young. I had a good time talking to him last year. Not necessarily a player you want to have on your team long-term.
Oh, and he brings some value, his shooting, and he can score. I think he's a good bench player to come in and try and bump up the scoring on your second unit. It's just not someone I would have invested in long-term. Memphis. Vince Carter. Very good signing. Do you think Carter is an upgrade to Mike Miller, what he did for them last year?
He's not as good of a shooter, obviously. Not as good of a rebounder or a passer either. But I think that he's, you know, Mike Miller staying healthy for all 82 games last year might have been the biggest fluke in the league. And I think that Vince is a better bet to stay healthy. And I think that Vince also gives them a little bit more of a secondary ball handler in terms of being able to work side pick and rolls and things like that, which Memphis very often needs to do because they don't have a lot of shooting, so they need to generate spacing in other ways with multiple passes around the perimeter and multiple pick and rolls within the same possession, things like that. I think that was a good signing for them, and it was good value as well.
The real plus minus, or RAPM, whatever you want to go by, absolutely loves Vince Carter.
I do too, but I'm also, you know, shamelessly in the tank for anyone who went to UNC, which I was a fan of growing up.
Oh, okay. I didn't realize you were a North Carolina fan growing up.
Yeah. Oh, dude. That 97-98 team with him and Anton Jameson, I love that team. I love, you know, the 05 team, even though, you know, they had Raymond Felton. the 09 team was probably my favorite, though, like with Lawson and those guys. I love that team. Lawson, Ellington.
You're not old enough to like the team that beat Michigan in the championship game, are you? That's a little bit before you would remember.
A little bit before. I was like 5 years old for that team.
Yeah, see, that's I hold hatred towards North Carolina. I was like
the Rasheed Wallace.
No,
Eric Montross.
It was before Rasheed wasn't on the team. The Fat Five.
So Stackhouse and those guys.
No, it wasn't even Stackhouse. It was George Lynch, Montross. That Michigan loss to that team was a freaking disgrace. I'm going to get angry about that. Let's move on to the Miami Heat. The Heat, what it all comes down to, look, Dang and McRoberts are nice players. Bosch is really good. what it comes down to, they brought back Chris Anderson, Haslam, added Sean Williams. They obviously lost LeBron James. What it comes down to for me is that team hasn't functioned with Wade on the court and LeBron not playing for like 3 years now. Can Wade get back to a level of play that he can be the main offensive creator on a team? That's what needs to happen for them to be successful. If that doesn't happen, they're not going to be good.
See, I think that Bosch should be their main offensive guy. I think that he's clearly a better player than Wade at this point in their careers, and he can do more things than Wade. I think that they did well to salvage the offseason once they lost LeBron. Obviously, they paid Bosch a heck of a lot of money to stay. That was good. Deng should help them with their wing defense. Mick Roberts is a nice player to function in the front court with Bosch. They'll have good passing and shooting from both front court positions. I wasn't the biggest Shabazz Napier fan in terms of his NBA prospects. And I thought that the suggestion that drafting him would ensure LeBron came back was ludicrous on his face. And they gave up value to move up to pick him, which I thought was even more ludicrous. But I think that they're still going to be good. Like, they got Wade and they got Bosch to stay, which I think was the most important. Wade was never going to leave. Getting Bosch to stay after LeBron left was the most important part of their offseason. But they also got, you know, Mick Roberts and Granger and Deng, which will help upgrade their depth. And, you know, getting Birdman to stay was good too. So I think they're going to be fine. They're not going to be the best team in the East, and they're not the finals favorite. But I think that they did well enough to salvage things after LeBron left.
All right, so I agree with your premise that Bosch is the best player on the team. No argument there. But is Bosch with Mick Roberts, a solid Luol Deng, with Wade who plays 65 games and doesn't hold up physically? I mean, is that really that good?
I think it's a playoff team. I think they're clearly a playoff team.
I think they're part of the large group that could be a playoff team. I don't think they're a lock for a playoff spot. I'm probably in the minority on that.
I guess I'm a little bit higher on them than you then.
Yeah, I thought Indiana and Miami really hurt them. I did not. I was really down on what both of those teams did. Another team, the Bucks. I don't have much there.
They made an insane play for Jason Kidd.
Well, yeah, that okay. There's that. They're going to be fun, but it wasn't really based on anything they did this offseason.
Well, I think that getting Jabari was great.
Yeah, no, the draft. I meant free agency wise. Nothing that they did in free agency impacts them going to be fun to watch this year.
Did they even do anything in free agency?
Kendall Marshall and Jared Bayless.
Right. I mean, Marshall's a nice enough backup point guard. He's not, you know, he's not great, and he's terrible on defense. And the shooting last year was almost definitely a fluke, but. He's a good passer, and if he can pass to Jabari and Giannis and Sanders and Henson and whoever the hell else they have along their front line, that's, you know, 47 guys. They have 47 point guards and 47 power forwards. It's basically what that team comes down to.
They're another Bledsoe team. That Brandon Knight, I couldn't think of a more perfect player for Brandon Knight to be paired with than Eric Bledsoe.
I think that Brandon Knight is more of an off-the-bench scorer type, so I guess that I agree there.
Yeah, it's just that, and I don't think he's a true point, I don't think he's the guy you want as your main ball handler, so to have him with a guy who could be the main ball handler plus defend twos and let Knight defend the ones really would have made sense for him, and a team like Milwaukee, I think Bledsoe would have, I mean, him and Giannis, Henson, I mean, all of the athletes, that would have been awesome.
Yeah. Now that you rationalize it like that, that makes sense. I'm with you.
All right. So I don't got Minnesota. Well, we kind of talked about them with Love, so it doesn't really make sense to rehash all that. How do you think Wiggins fits in with that team?
I think it's going to be fun. You know, him and LaVine on the wings, and Rubio, and I mean, they're going to be bad but fun to watch. I think that if they flip Anthony Bennett for Thad for a year of Thad Young, that's a mistake. You know, Bennett was the number one pick in the draft a year ago, and he's still, you know, maybe people didn't think he should have been the number one, but he was still a guy that was one of the 5 or 10 best players in that draft, and he came in out of shape and he had a bad season. That's an undervalued asset now. I don't think you would ever trade the number one pick in the draft for Thaddeus Young, especially not if you're only getting Thaddeus Young for a year, which is what would happen because he would not stay there long term. I think it would be a big mistake to deal a guy who could possibly be a foundational player for a year of a solid bet.
And as we've said twice already, that you shouldn't read too much into Summer League. But Bennett, look, I'm not saying how good he's going to be, but he at least looked to take steps in the right direction with him being in shape and being able to score the basketball in
right.
some fashion.
You know, he looked certainly a lot better than he did at any point last year.
The Pelicans, talent-wise, seem to be pretty good. You might not agree with all the contracts they've given out, but they have, I mean, the trades that they've made, but they have Anthony Davis, and now with Ashik, Evans, Holiday, Eric Gordon, I mean, it's a talented basketball team. It's just a question of whether it all fits together.
I liked this offseason for them a lot more than I liked last offseason. I did not like the Holiday trade. I did not like the Evans signing. I like the Ashik trade in theory. Although, again, you know, now they've given up 3 first-round picks, essentially, for Jrue Holiday and Omer Ashik, which I think is crazy. But if they can get Ashik and Davis to work together, I think it depends sort of if Davis does wind up stretching his range out as far as it looks like he's trying to. But I also sort of wanted Davis to revolutionize the center position, and so it was never the same again, which is what, you know, KG should have done, but he insisted on being a power forward. And now it looks like the same thing's going to happen with Davis. You know, maybe he wasn't big enough to guard Marc Gasol and Dwight Howard, but the kid's 21. He's going to put on weight. Like, eventually it would have happened, and he's a mismatch for whoever he plays against at center. I mean, the same is largely true at power forward, but, you know, what are you going to do? I think that Ashik obviously is a massive upgrade for them defensively. But now they're paying Ryan Anderson like $11 million a year or whatever it is to be a backup forward, which, I mean, if they try to play those 3 guys together along the front line, I think that's a mistake, just like it was when they played Anderson, Davis, and Robin Lopez together, because none of them can really guard threes. I mean, we'll see. It's going to be up to Monty Williams to make everything fit together. So we'll see how that happens.
Yeah, they're going to be an interesting team to watch. All right, to our Knicks. I like Jason Smith. I like the trade they made with Dallas. Obviously, I like Cole Aldridge, the greatest center in NBA history. They got Melo back. They're in a weird spot, though, where I like what they're doing long-term from a roster perspective, but I don't know if they're going to maximize Carmelo Anthony if they plan on using him as a small forward for the rest of his career.
The Knicks got Shane Larkin. I'm happy.
End of discussion. Greatest offseason ever.
We've talked so much about the Knicks in these podcasts, and I don't know if we can rehash the same things over and over again. It's, you know,
repetitive.
Encouraging, but we'll see.
Yeah. All right, we'll just give them a we'll say. The Thunder. Lost Thabo, lost Butler, added Anthony Morrow. Did they move the meter for you at all? And they did some weird draft things, too.
Well, I think that not having Derek Fisher around to take minutes away from better, younger players is a win. I think that I like the Mitch McGarry draft pick. Even though people say they could have gotten him later, I think it was a good pick. I think he if he was healthy and not suspended for pot, he would have been, you know, a lottery talent, and where they got him was good. I like the Anthony Morrow move in terms of helping their spacing. I think a lot of their, what it's going to come down to for them is whether they play the right guys in the right combinations at the right times. You know, Russ and KD and Ibaka are good enough to carry them as far as they want to go. We'll see what happens. I still think that not amnestying Kendrick Perkins at any point is a mistake. Especially it would have freed up the full level for them to chase a guy who's like Anthony Morrow but better. For example, last year they could have chased after Kyle Korver, whatever it was, 2 years ago. And if they keep playing Perkins 25-30 minutes a game, I think that's a mistake. I think Steven Adams should be the day one starting center. I doubt that happens. But we'll see.
Yeah, especially with McGarry there to take up kind of the energy role that Adams played last year. So you can slide McGarry into the Adams role, then Adams can be your starting center. And you have Collison.
You know what? I also think it was a mistake to not draft someone who could play at 29. you know, the Houston thing, you know, whatever you want to say about whether it's good or bad for the league to be able to circumvent the cap like that, Oklahoma said he could have used a young contributor on the team. And obviously, cheaper to have not have the guy on the roster at all. But if you want to just not have a guy on the roster, cut fucking Kendrick Perkins. Like, come on.
Yeah, but that costs money.
Like, they could have come out of the draft with McGarry and Kyle Anderson.
Wow, I never thought of it like that.
Like, Oklahoma City took him the next pick.
Jeez.
Or
yeah.
San Antonio for the next pick.
That would, and he would have been. Having a ball mover like that with the pieces they have would have been awesome.
Right, especially for a team that struggles in terms of generating ball movement late in games. I think that would have been really good. And then he could have been protected on defense by, you know, KD and Ibaka. So I think that would have been a really good thing for them.
Yeah.
Of course, Slav Resti would rather, you know, keep Kendrick Perkins around and circumvent the cap by stashing a guy in the D-League. Obviously, it's legal to do that. It's not really circumventing the cap, but it was still dumb.
Yeah, no, that's a really good point. I never thought of that from the Kyle Anderson perspective. Wow, that would have been an awesome pick for them. Orlando. Ben Gordon, Channing Frye, Luke Ridenour.
Don't get the Ben Gordon thing. I mean, I somewhat get it in terms of you need mid-level salaries to match in trades. So on that level, it makes some sense. And, you know, there are worse ways to spend $4.5 million than that Ben Gordon rediscovers the ability to shoot and not be a dick. I like the Frye move. I think you saw that he helped Dragic and Bledsoe last year immensely in terms of his shooting, being able to draw guys away from them to drive on the pick and roll. I think that will help Elfrid Payton and Victor Oladipo in their development. And I think that it allows Aaron Gordon to sort of play three on defense and the four on offense because Frye will spend so much of his time outside, which lets Gordon lurk along the baseline and in the corner and make cuts and things like that, and then defend wings. So I think that signing is going to help them a bunch. And I especially like that they made it so it declines in value over the course of the contract, which will provide more cap space on the back end.
Am I wrong to still like Evan Fournier?
I don't know if you're necessarily wrong. I'm not super high on him. And I don't think that they got enough out of Aaron Aflalo. But that doesn't make Fournier less of an intriguing guy.
The Philadelphia 76ers literally did nothing in free agency.
Of course.
They added no one. I got the Sports Illustrated as a great thing that just takes you in alphabetical order for everything they've done. Added zero, lost nothing. I don't know if we want to get... I mean, there's a whole discussion to have on the 76ers, but I think that's a podcast within itself.
Yeah, you know, maybe we'll do that next week. Obviously, for them, everything is going to depend on how these last few drafts have turned out.
Yeah, so we'll just leave.
And the next few.
Yeah, we'll just leave that for another time. I do think it is an interesting thing to discuss. The Suns. Tucker re-signed. Hopefully he stops drinking extreme amounts of alcohol and getting into cars. That was really not intelligent. They got Isaiah Thomas. Anthony Tolliver to try and recreate. He played a lot of three last year for the Bobcats or whatever that team is now. I'm confused. And they're going to move him back to the four, and they're going to try and recreate some of what Fry did with Tolliver. I don't get why they didn't bring Fry back, and I don't know what's going on there. That I live in Phoenix. I cover them on a somewhat regular basis. And I think there's something that went on behind the scenes that was unsaid, if I'm being honest.
You would know that better than me, being there and you know, just following the team more closely. We literally just talked about how much Fry helped Dragic and Bledsoe. So it's going to hurt not having him back. The Thomas contract, you know, is right up there with Dirk and Lance in terms of the best contract signed this summer. A lot of people think it was sort of overkill, like, oh, you have Dragic and Bledsoe already. What do you need Isaiah Thomas for? Well, the answer is, if you're going to play two point guards at all times, having three good ones isn't a problem. It's a necessity. And now they'll be able to mix and match those three guys through the two backcourt spots. I think they can all play together to varying levels of success. Obviously, pairing either one of Dragic or Thomas with Bledsoe will be more successful than pairing Dragic and Thomas together, just because Bledsoe is a better defender and able to guard twos than both of those other guys. But I think that all three combinations can work, and at this point, Hornacek has shown nothing to make me not trust that he'll be able to figure that out.
Yeah, you nailed it right there, is that their offense died when Dragic didn't play last year. As good as Bledsoe is as a two-way player, he didn't show he was able to carry the offense on his own. So they're generating, basically having a slightly lower level of Dragic and Thomas to put with Bledsoe when Goran goes to the bench. That made perfect sense, and at the money they got it for, there was no reason not to do it, especially with how clean their cap sheet is going forward with all the young players. And they're also set up that they still have pieces to make a trade. Do you like TJ Warren or not?
Not really. And I saw him play a bunch at NC State when they played Miami. I'm not a very big fan. That said, a guy that athletic, if you can harness it in the right way, can become a good NBA player.
And the Suns, I mean, Markieff Morris is basically their only front court player that can really create a shot for himself. And they have a lot of guys who can shoot threes, they can take it to the bucket, and he diversifies their offense a little bit in a good way.
A little bit, yeah. I don't necessarily know how many minutes he's going to get, just because they have so many of like that combo forward type already. You know, they have the Morai and Tucker and Tolliver. That's already a lot of guys taking up a lot of minutes. And then at center, you already have Plumlee and Len, probably. So, I mean, we'll see if he can even find minutes. But anytime you have a guy that athletic, again, it's very much like a lower-level sort of Perry Jones, where if you can harness the athleticism in the right way, you can turn him into a useful player.
And to your point about finding minutes for him, with the two point guards, they're going to be playing pretty much at all times. Gerald Green's also going to have to play some time at the three to be able to get him some run during games, too. Another team in the Western Conference, the Portland Trail Blazers. Chris Kaman and Steve Blake lost Mo Williams. No, that's not.
Ooh, boy.
Yeah.
Not a fan of their offseason.
No. Blake's okay. I don't mind Blake as a backup point guard. I know he didn't do well with Golden State last year, but I think there's
Blake
years of that.
The Kaman signing makes no sense to me.
He kind of fits in Portland, I feel like.
Like,
I'm talking about, like, from a. Just like, I feel like he's like a Portland City person. It kind of makes sense that way.
Oh, yeah, sure.
Basketball related.
They needed to get a big who could play defense with their mid-level exception.
They basically needed another Robin Lopez.
Right.
They needed to, like, multiplicity of
them. Opposite.
Yeah, I thought the Trailblazers overachieved more than any team last year, and I don't think they did anything this offseason to make... If I were to pick a team to drop out of the Western Conference playoffs that made it last year, Portland would be the team.
Yep. Right right there with you. We talked about it a couple times on, you know, your old podcasts last season, that they were playing over their heads. And, I mean, we'll see what happens if they can recreate the sort of Aldridge and reigning threes offense from last year. But I think it's going to come down to they're not very good defensively. And unless they can find a way to internally upgrade that through, you know, Batum and Matthews and Lillard playing better defense especially, it's going to be tough for them to recreate the season they had last year.
The Sacramento Kings decided it was a good idea to let Isaiah Thomas go and sign Darren Collison. So, yeah.
One of the worst moves of the offseason.
Did you watch the Grantland stuff on them?
I did.
Oh, yeah, you're right there, so you probably watch stuff like that. That owner scares me. If I were a Kings fan, I'd be terrified.
I spoke with Vivek last season for an interview.
That's right.
He's a very smart guy, very thoughtful guy. Amin El-Hassan, who I know that you know and follow on Twitter as well, was talking about how he wouldn't like his owner being that involved in the draft day process, like it shows in the video, because once he says, you know, I like Stauskas,
yeah.
At that point, what is anybody else going to say? Stauskas, too, but I didn't necessarily think that was the best pick for them in that spot, especially if they were going to let Isaiah Thomas go. We'll see what happens there. They're building a sort of, if not necessarily a very good team, a very interesting team in terms of the different kinds of guys they have that can do different things. And I love Boogie, so I want to see them and him succeed. It's obviously a situation that's still very much in flux.
Cousins is also one of my favorite players, and Nick Stauskas has been my Twitter avatar on and off for 2 years now. So there's that for me. I always go back to the Grantland. Some of the stuff they did was so weird, like hiring the people from colleges to help with their draft and some of the research they were doing for it. Like what?
There's a lot to the wisdom of the crowd. You know, ESPN has done that thing over the last few years that has shown generally the crowd is more accurate than a single sort of person doing the same type of analysis. We'll see what happens there.
Here's what I thought was some of the stuff they were researching. I was like, that just seems like a waste of your time and money. Like the history of what the production you get out of the 8th pick or whatever it was that they have. You can't really do that because every draft is its own entity. So it doesn't really matter what got taken at the 8th pick in prior drafts because this draft is completely different from any other draft that's happened. So I just feel
I somewhat agree, but I also think it's useful to know like the average production you can expect out of a certain spot. Just in terms of value and trades, because that was one of the things, if you watch the video, they were looking into was trading the pick, either to move up or down. One of the offers that they said they had on the table was from Philly, was the 10 and 2 second round picks for number 8, which I would have snatched up if I were them.
Yeah, I would have done that too. I believe very much in not believing in yourself that you are smarter than everyone else in the draft and giving yourself more options. And
if we accept that the draft is basically a crapshoot, which I think has been proven over the years, then I think it's more important than anything else is to give yourself as many options as possible, whether they're in the first round or the second round, to cash in as many lottery tickets as you have.
Yeah, it's a little different than the NFL. I really 100% believe in that theory in the NFL. The NBA is slightly different because you don't have as many roster spots and it's only a 2-round draft and a singular player in the NBA can make so much of a difference outside of, and with the NFL, quarterback's really the only position that can do that, so it's a little bit different. but I do think some of the same theories for how teams deal with the NFL draft do hold in the NBA too.
Yeah, especially in a draft that was touted as deep as this one was. I think that giving yourself more shot, as many shots as possible to hit, was a good idea.
I love this next team, what they did. The Toronto Raptors basically brought back everyone that they had from last year, Lowry, Patterson, Grievous Vasquez, and then added James Johnson to try and cover up one of their bigger flaws that was exposed in the playoffs. The reason they one of the biggest reasons they lost that Nets series was because they couldn't defend Joe Johnson. Now you bring in a guy like James Johnson, who is a bigger small forward that can defend bigger guys.
Yep, totally agree with every single thing you just said. That's like, if you had just said, what do you think about the Raptors? I would have said the exact same thing you just said.
Do you think they can win the East?
No, because I think Cleveland's going to win the East.
Do you think they're better than Chicago?
Maybe. I think that, you know, if you played the East out 100 times, Toronto's probably better than Chicago like 30 or 35 times. But that, you know, Chicago has the higher, if healthy, ceiling. If you understand what I'm trying to say.
That 100% makes sense, yes. I do like, I haven't looked in a while, and I stopped gambling a long time ago, but I did think about putting money into account to bet on the Raptors at like 20-1 to win the East. That was before the Cavs got LeBron. I'm not sure if it was before or after the Cavs got LeBron James, but I do think that's a good value bet if it's still around 20-1.
Yeah, you know, they're certainly one of the next group. I think it goes Cleveland, then Chicago, and then like five or six teams that are all in a similar group, with Toronto, Washington, Atlanta, Charlotte, Miami, Brooklyn. I think they're all like sort of grouped together.
Yeah, that's fair. Utah brought back Hayward, Booker, nice backup signing. Williams, Jefferson, and Rush lost all of them. They're internal development. I don't think obviously bringing back Hayward. I thought that was something they needed to do. I don't think Utah was in a position to lose him for nothing.
Yeah, I agree. I think he's making a little bit too much, but you can also, you know, try to trade him. That was something that the Nuggets did with JaVale McGee. With the Nets. They gave him a contract that they thought was a little bit too much money, and then they started shopping him.
Yeah.
I think that might be a decent idea to do with Gordon Hayward.
Do you think Burke and Exum can play together?
From the little I've seen of Exum, yes. I think that the two of them are both creative enough off the dribble, and if Burke gets back to shooting like he did in college rather than like he did last year, I think that can work.
It's weird. And I was a big Burke believer. I thought he was going to be a good NBA player. And I don't think of that about all Michigan players. So I'm not just a homer about it.
Well, I know how you feel about Jimmy Hardaway.
Yeah, as we said with the Knicks, we won't broach any of those topics here. One of the weirdest things from a transition from college is how he doesn't know how to shoot anymore. I mean, we're talking about two summer leagues and the season where he shot like crap. And
I think a lot of it last year was that they were just so bad. And I think that both Burke and Hayward suffered from having to create too much on their own. And a lot of that fell on, you know, the unimaginative stuff that Ty Corbin was doing. We'll see whether or not that changes under Quinn Snyder. I'm optimistic that it will. I like Snyder. I thought that he was a guy who, back when he was at Missouri, they were talking about him as a possible guy who could make the jump to the NBA. And then he had that whole scandal happen. He's had to work his way all the way back, and now he's finally done it. He's a really creative coach, and I think he'll do a lot better things for those guys than Ty Corbin did.
And finally, our last team. We made it through all 30, and in somewhat reasonable amount of time. We didn't go too long here. The Washington Wizards. Gortat, Pierce, Gooden, Humphreys, Blair, Serafin. The part that I think gets analyzed the most and the most important part of this is the Ariza for Pierce swap. What did you think of it?
Another one of my favorite offseasons in the league this year. Bringing Cortot was necessary. He was a huge part of their offense and defense in terms of, you know, handoffs and screens on offense and post-ups. And then, you know, when he shared the floor with Nene and Wall, their defense was just spectacular. It was, you know, a top five level defense. And that's really important to them continuing to be good. I think that Pierce injects them with some more creativity on the wings than Ariza did. And I would not have liked giving Ariza a whole lot of money if I was that team. Renting out that space on Pierce was a really good move. I like the DeJuan Blair move a lot in terms of a back big man. And you know, they're going to need to get some out of Otto Porter because Martell Webster had that surgery. So they're going to need Porter to develop. But the big thing for them is making sure Wall and Beal continue on the path they're on. And I think that Pierce helps, and I think Gortat helps.
I like Humphreys as the backup big more than Blair. I'm still not.
Oh, yeah, Humphreys was good too. I think that both of those were good.
And for a team, I think having, again, this is, I talked about this a little with Caron Butler. I think it's even more important here. Bringing in Pierce with this team and where they are and having him to help them in the playoffs and help Wall Beal along. And while he's also still very good on the court, I think is a huge, I think that's a big time upgrade on Ariza from that perspective.
Listen, I mean, I've been very vocal about being very anti-Paul Pierce for a long time, but there are things that he brings that are undeniable. You know, the guy never misses big shots, and every team he's been on since he grew up after, you know, the KG and Ray Allen trades has been better for presence, you know, whether in the locker room or on the court. So I think that he'll help them a lot.
And I'm not a person, I've done it twice in this podcast with Butler and Pierce, I'm not a person that really gets into the whole what goes on behind the scenes. I think that stuff's really hard to quantify, but I also do think it's important and there is something to it.
Yeah, there's something to it, I would agree. I tend to think, you know, I've been very vocally against it, but it's not that I think it doesn't matter, it's that I think it gets overvalued.
And a lot of times
it gets valued more than on-court play, which is, I think, really dumb. But not to say it doesn't have value. It should just be an ancillary consideration, not the primary consideration.
And it's also impossible, unless you have incredible inside information about the dynamics of a locker room, to know what's actually going on.
Right.
So it's really hard.
Or to even predict what will go on in a new situation.
Well, we thought we were done, but in my excitement from going from the Sacramento Kings to the Toronto Raptors, because I was just so fired up to talk about the Raptors, I accidentally skipped the San Antonio Spurs. So, I mean, it was status quo. The Spurs do the things the Spurs did. They brought back Patty Mills, some injury concerns there. Boris Diaw re-signed, Matt Bonner re-signed, and they didn't lose anyone.
Yeah, they brought back all their guys on discounted deals, which is basically just what the Spurs do at this point, and they quietly announced extensions for both Greg Popovich and Tony Parker, which again is basically just what the Spurs do. So they had a good offseason, and they also brought in Ettore Messina to be an assistant to Pop and the first full-time female coach in the NBA, Becky Hammon. So the Spurs stay being the Spurs. Trendsetters bringing back guys on value contracts, and they'll probably get Kawhi Leonard locked up in an extension before the season starts. So yeah, the Spurs just stay the Spurs.
What's an aspect of this that will be fun to see going forward is after the core of Duncan, Parker, and Ginobili is gone, will the philosophies that they put in place stick with them? Will the next group of players that they get also take less money to allow them to build fuller teams, fuller rosters.
Well, the thing when you talk about that is, you know, Duncan made a whole lot of money ever before he started taking less.
Oh,
so
yeah.
I think, you know, so that's got to be a consideration. But, you know, let's say they lock up Kawhi Leonard to a max extension right now. I think we both agree that he's worth that and that it's going to look really good in a couple of years when the cap starts shooting up. So even if they don't get him to take less, it's going to wind up being a value contract within a couple of years anyway.
And you think they give him the 5-year? They have the ability to, right? They have the 5-year opening, right?
I think they do, yeah, and I don't see why they wouldn't.
Yeah, and he's... I want to see him in a... I do believe he can develop into a player that can be a bigger role, hold a higher percentage of the offense. I think we're starting to see glimpses of that already, but I don't think it's a fact that he gets to that point in his career.
Right, I don't think you necessarily want him to be a guy who's, you know, a 30% usage rate type guy. I think you want to keep it down somewhat so he can keep expending all that energy on defense that he does. That makes him one of the best wing defenders in the league. Obviously, you want to expand his role a little bit offensively with each passing season, but you don't necessarily want to put too much on his plate to the point where his defense suffers.
I was one of the people that argued that I thought he was going to be a better player than Paul George. Non-injury stuff aside, I don't know, because we don't know if those two were flipped in roles. George maybe is a better offensive player than he is with what he has to do in Indiana. So I don't know if it's completely fair, but I think Kawhi was the better player based on what he had to do in San Antonio.
It's tough. I don't know if I could say one way or the other. You know, obviously George just has so much more offensive responsibility than Kawhi did. So it's tough to really judge based on that.
Yeah, I completely agree with that. Did you think the Becky Hammon thing was a big deal or no?
I think it's a big deal insofar as it's a step in, you know, a direction that the league has never taken. Obviously, for the Spurs, it's just business as usual. They're adding a coach they think is going to make them better. You know, for the league and the social issues and things like that, it's a big deal. But to the Spurs internally, it's probably not.
Do you think a woman could ever be a head coach of a men's basketball team?
Do I think they could?
No. Not from a... Are they capable of doing it? But do you think a team would ever have the guts to go in that direction?
You know, right now in the current league, I don't think it's going to happen anytime soon. That doesn't mean that it won't eventually.
It'd be the how a team would react to some. I think that's the biggest concern when it's something like that, is how the players on the team would react to that.
Yeah, I mean, I think you already saw, you know, some guys who aren't in the league, like Matt Walsh, the guy who used to play for Florida, said on Twitter that he would never listen to a woman coach. So, I mean, there are still attitudes like that. Obviously, San Antonio is a strong enough organization that they can handle any sorts of internal strife like that. Not that there should be any, but I think it's also a reality of the situation that there might be in other organizations that aren't as strong as that, that don't know how to deal with things on that level. You know, it's a sad reality that something like that would be expected to happen, but I think that that's also the reality. In a different organization, things might not go as smoothly.
It's very much like the Michael Sam thing in the NFL, where you wish we were at the point as a society where it wasn't a thing and it could just go on, and a gay player could just go into an NFL locker room and it wouldn't be a story and it wouldn't be a big deal to the teammates. But just, that's not true. That's just not how the world works. And it's,
well, I don't know if I necessarily agree with that. Jason Collins came into the Nets locker room last year, and, you know, after the first few days where, you know, it was a big story because he was the first openly gay player ever, people went back to talking to the guys on the team that contribute a lot. Like, I went into the locker room after Nets playoff games, Jason Collins, rest in peace, and left the locker room without anybody talking to him half the time because he's not a guy that was doing a lot of things on the court. And I think that will happen with Michael Sam eventually as well. People will only want to talk to him because of the things he does on the field eventually, just like eventually people will only want to talk to Becky Hammon if the Spurs allow their assistant coaches to talk to the media about things that happen on the court. That eventually that will take place. Obviously, she's the first one to be doing this full time, and there will be a lot of stories about that, about her as a trendsetter, about the Spurs as trailblazers, about how she's fitting in, things like that. But eventually she'll just become another assistant coach, which is the place where we want to get to.
Yeah, exactly, and unfortunately there are idiots like Matt Walsh and whoever else thinks in that way. All that matters is if she knows basketball and can coach basketball, that's all that should matter in the situation.
And that's exactly what Greg Popovich said after they hired her.
And anything else on the Spurs you have to add?
The Spurs stay the Spurs, man. You know, they're one of the finals favorites once again.
I was about to say, so to wrap this up, after everything we've seen this offseason, Spurs and Thunder, the two top teams in the league, is that where we stand, or you think the Cavs are in that mix?
That's tough. I don't know if I could say one way or the other. I think that the Spurs and the Thunder are definitely in there. I think we have to see the Cavs on the court before we can definitively say whether they're in there as well.
Yeah, if I were to pick two favorites, I think right now the Spurs and Thunder are kind of above everyone else. I think they're just more complete. I think the Cavs are going to be awesome and fun, and it'll take them a little time, but they'll get it figured out. But I do think,
yeah, I don't think their defense is on the level of the Spurs or the Thunder.
It's just quite, if that that offense could just be so insanely good.
Right. It's going to be a sight to behold.
It's going to be fun, and the NBA season is nearing. That wraps up our off-season talk. We'll have more coming in the future. That's this edition of the Podium Game podcast on the HP Basketball Network.